We've got some visitors here. We're glad for that. We are continuing our study of young faces of faith. Again, this is some material that Mark Bingham worked up for us this quarter. We just started kind of the second half of this material, looking at various young or youngish people that we encounter in the scriptures and learning about their examples of faith. Along the way, we're looking also at some counterexamples of not so much faith, if you will. We've already talked about David along the way with this, and we're going to meet David. David's a central character today, but he's not the central character that we're considering. We're considering the story of David and Abigail. 1 Samuel 25 is where I'd like you to go. We're going to look at our good example first, then we'll backtrack and look at our counter example, which is Jezebel. And we'll look at faith and its influence in relationships, particularly the marriage relationship in this case, and its influence on others. 1 Samuel chapter 25. First of all, what period of David's life do these events take place in? Is he king yet? Is he young? Is he old? What's going on? Okay, he's still young. He's not king yet. 1 Samuel 25 is that period in David's life that we talked about not too long ago, actually. When he and his men are out in the countryside, out in the wilderness, because he has been forced to flee from Saul's court, and from time to time Saul takes his forces out into the wilderness to try and seek David and take his life, rather than attending to affairs of state, that's its own disaster. But David and his men are out in the wilderness, and of course during this time we mentioned this, that during this time more and more men are flocking to David's banner. A lot of them are outcasts like he is. His nephews, the sons of his sister Zeruiah, join him and all that kind of thing. So David and his men are in the countryside. 1 Samuel chapter 25 describes how they were providing protection for sheep ranchers, particularly for the flocks and the shepherds of those flocks, to kind of keep them from becoming victimized by marauders and that kind of thing. And who is the particular wealthy owner of flocks that we encounter in 1 Samuel 25? What's his name? All right, his name is Nabal. David and his men are providing protection for Nabal's shepherds and sheep. And sheep shearing time comes around. We're going to talk about sheep in our next hour a little bit. But this was a time traditionally of celebration and of generosity. The expectation was that a wealthy herdsman like Nabal, when sheep shearing time came, in the midst of the celebration would be extending provisions and other kinds of gifts to those in his sphere of influence. And it would seem only natural. Here David and his men have been providing protection for Nabal, for him to do that for them. In fact, David sends men to Nabal to ask for provisions. How does Nabal respond to that request? Not too good. Okay, that's a consensus. Not too good. All right. He acts like he doesn't even know who David is. The words he uses probably means he regards David as of no account. He treats this as an insult and an imposition that a nobody like David is asking him for, in spite of all the things that David and his men have been doing for Nabal. And so he rebuffs David's men. He refuses the request. He speaks insultingly of David. The men go back to David, and this is to me one of the most interesting little episodes in David's early career. Because when this gets back to David, what does he say? What does he do? Oh, he's ready for revenge. To what extent? He tells his men to strap on their swords and says, we're going to kill every male in Nabal's house. Now, how angry do you have to be? How insulted do you have to feel that that's your reaction? But that's where David is. So he sent these young men up to Carmel to visit Nabal. He has rebuffed them. Nabal refuses. So this is verse 13. Each of you gird on his sword, David said. So each man girded on his sword, and David girded on his sword. To verse 21. David had said, surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David and much more, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. So, okay, there's no way, by tomorrow, we're going to go kill every man in Nabal's household. Does this seem out of character for David to you? It kind of does to me. Knowing what we know about the rest of David's life and career and his actions, but perhaps this is an indicator that there's a dimension to David's emotional makeup that we haven't considered. He's also young, youngish anyway, and is in a difficult set of circumstances, he and his men. Jane? Yeah, that's not really made clear. I think at the very least we could say it was a cultural expectation, just because this is what you did. If you were a wealthy person around sheep shearing time, you're supposed to be generous to people, and you would think especially generous to people who were providing you some kind of benefit. Did they have some kind of arrangement worked out? I it's hard to say.
Yeah. Somebody showed up at your house and said, hey, I've been watching your house for the last year to make sure I'm looking into it.
Yeah.
Give me something for that.
Yeah.
Your first reaction would be, who are you?
Right.
I mean, there seems to be some disdain for David and his questioning, but I'm just, this is my wonder, because David reacts so extreme for this slight.
Yeah, it's clear that in David's view, this request should have been granted without hesitation.
Right.
Nabal's servants seem to be aware of the circumstances, because one of Nabal's servants speaks to his wife, who we really haven't mentioned yet, but she's our main character today. Who is it? What's her name? Her name is Abigail. And apparently, word of what David is planning has reached this servant, one of the young men of Nabal, and he says, look, you got to do something. Evil is planned against our master and his house. And what is this? Down in verse 16 and verse 17. Starting verse 14. One of the young men went to Nabal's wife and told her what had happened. The men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. Regardless of whatever arrangement had been worked out with Nabal, the servants of Nabal knew exactly what David and his men had been providing and were grateful for it. They were a wall to us by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now therefore, no one consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. This is one of our favorite New Testament, Old Testament expressions, son of Belial. A couple of times it is used to describe Nabal. Okay, he is worthless. He is profane. He does not respect what is holy. All those things kind of get wrapped up in this expression. And even his servants recognize that that's the kind of guy he is. And in private, to Nabal's wife, they are willing to say so. That gives you some insight into the man's character. So, what does Abigail do? Now, let's talk about our young face of faith here. What does Abigail take it on herself to do at this point?
Provide the provisions, plead for his life.
Okay. Unbeknownst to her husband, she loads up with provisions and heads down the road and meets David and his men who, presumably from the text, are on their way to where Nabal is to kill everybody. And she speaks, and this is how she speaks to David. Verse 23, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey, fell on her face before David, bowed herself to the ground, she fell at his feet, and said, "On me alone, O Lord, be the blame, and please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this son of Belial, this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent." And you may have a footnote in or column note in your Bible. What does the name Nabal mean? Do you think Nabal's parents gave him this name? I really hope not. I mean, you find in the Old Testament people naming their children all kinds of things, and sometimes they're not happy kinds of things because maybe they're named after some very difficult circumstance that was going on when they were born, and that's kind of commemorated. Well, yeah, that's unfortunate, but that was what a lot of people did. Or if it was a good thing, that would be commemorated. It's hard for me to imagine this man's parents, when he was born, naming him Fool. And if that was not the case, then it means he had earned this name. This is the name that for a long time everybody had known him by. Nabal, Fool. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him, his wife says. Now, here's Abigail in the position of acknowledging that her husband is a boor. He is a profane, foolish individual. And what is she in the position of doing now? She's in the position of trying to clean up his mess. And if time permitted, which it doesn't, I like to use this passage as a warning, especially to young ladies when they're considering a marriage partner. I don't think, I can imagine Abigail's marriage to Nabal was probably arranged, as so many marriages in that day were. And my warning is, don't willingly choose to marry a Nabal yourself, because you'll have to do what Abigail does. You will constantly be having to clean up after his foolishness. In this case, his life is in her hands, even though he doesn't know it. She is pleading for David not to carry out his plan to kill them, to kill all the men of Nabal's house. And so she says, don't pay any mind to my worthless husband. He is what his name is. He's a fool. Don't let that get to you, and don't let that cause you to do this. But we go on, verse 26. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. Now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who accompany my Lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant. For the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and the evil will not be found in you all your days. And there's more. Go ahead, Wayne.
Jeff, it doesn't explain or say a good bit about how Abigail came to be Nabal's wife. Probably she was presented to him by the family. He's rich, wealthy, and so forth, but we don't know exactly. But
right.
I do wonder why Abigail takes all the blame. That sounds strange to me, that here is a woman, and she's never in a position to take the blame. It's the husband, it's the man.
Sure.
But she does.
Yeah.
I think she does this to get David's attention, really. And it does get his attention. And she has a good heart about her. It's obvious.
Yeah.
And she's trying her best to save her husband's life and the men. And she does a good job of that.
Yeah. And that is a really good observation, because she keeps apologizing to David. She hasn't done anything wrong. She keeps apologizing as if she has transgressed in some way, even by coming out to meet David, and says, blame me for all this. It's clearly Nabal's fault. But it certainly succeeds in getting David's attention and in disarming him. Yeah, Shane, go ahead. Go ahead.
Just deal with him alone. He's to blame. But she doesn't do that. Despite of who her husband is and his character, she as a wife goes on, goes to bat, I guess is what I'm saying for his life.
Yeah. Very good. Barry?
I think it also speaks to her faith that the Lord will protect her, and that David is a man of God, and things will go well. I do think it speaks to her faith in general.
And that brings us to one of the questions our lesson book asks. What does Abigail seem to perceive about David that's built into this whole conversation?
She knows that he's the Lord's anointed.
Okay. Yeah, it's clear she knows he's the Lord's anointed, that God is going to do great things for David. Do you see anything? Do you see any perceptions on her part about David's character, maybe, Shane?
Well, she does get the, even if she didn't know David prior to this, she does get the report from the young man back earlier in the chapter that we never want, we never worry about anything, nothing went missing. For a man to have all these people following him, and none of them ever just took it upon themselves to take something because they felt like they deserved it or any other reason. She received a report of not only David, but David's men and how they behaved before she embarks on this adventure. So even if nothing else, on the testimony of the young man, she knew of his character.
Okay. All right. Look at what she says to David as she's pleading with him. Verse 26, "Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives," and by the way, generally people don't talk that way unless they have great faith in God. The Lord is a big part of her conversation. "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood." You see what she's doing? You know God doesn't want you to do that. You know God is keeping you from doing this. He is restraining you from doing this. Even though, that's the reason she has come to David. "Since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against you be like Nabal. Let them all be as foolish and worthless as he is. And let God prosper you." That's the next several verses. Because I know God's going to do that. She is essentially speaking in past tense of what she hopes David will do, or in this case, not do. And that shows confidence in God, and it shows confidence, I think, shows confidence in David's commitment to God and David's own character. She appeals to him as to one who knows that this is not right. Let's pause and think about this before we look at David's reaction. Pause and think about this. It's impossible to know, but if David goes through with this, what are the ramifications of that? If David and his men kill Nabal and all his men over an insult, what could result from that?
The Lord could be displeased.
You think God would be happy with that?
David's acting out of his own regard. Okay.
We read not long ago when we were studying David as an exemplar of young faith. A couple of occasions when David, he's out there on the run from Saul, same period in his life, he's out there on the run from Saul, has two golden opportunities to kill Saul. Once in the cave, and once when he and Abishai sneak down into Saul's camp by night. Could have dispatched Saul easily. And remember, both times David's men are encouraging him to do it. They're encouraging him to do it because they know God has chosen him to be Saul's replacement. Let's just go ahead and make that happen. Here's the opportunity God promised you, David. And down in Saul's camp, Abishai, as he usually does, let me kill him. That's all Abishai ever wants to do, is kill people. Let me pin him to the ground. I'll only have to strike once. I'll take care of it for you. And then our problems will be solved. You can be king. And David wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't he do it? Okay. Maybe, is it possible that that explains the difference here? Saul is the Lord's anointed. And by the way, David never stops respecting and even loving Saul, despite how rotten Saul is to it. But he never stops respecting Saul's position as the Lord's anointed and will not take action against him without a directive from God, which he does not have. His men think that it's providence, but Nabal, on the other hand, well, he's not a complete nobody, but he's not the anointed king of Israel either. He's a wealthy sheepherder. And maybe in David's mind that's different. But Abigail appeals to him as one who knows deep down this is not right, and we need to get back to what we were talking about. Go ahead, Wayne, go ahead.
Jeff, it seems to me, obvious to me, maybe it doesn't, but that Abigail is aware of this fact that he had spared Saul. You know, his men would talk about that. They would even probably say, we offered to take care of this situation for him, but he wouldn't allow it. And I think word would get around when she says, the Lord has kept you from shedding in his blood. I think she's referring to that. Okay. What I'm going to believe.
Could be. That's something I hadn't considered, but that could very well be. And if that's the case, then she's, you spared Saul twice. Show the same character, the same mercy, the same restraint before the Lord in this case. Again, I asked this and really didn't give you all a chance to answer. What could, if David goes through with this, what could it do to his reputation, his image? Okay. I mean, is this the, It could possibly be declaring to the public that the replacement God has chosen to replace Saul is really not any better, morally. He's not any better character than the one he's replacing. And of course, that was the whole point. David was a man after God's own heart. Is David right to be angry at this insult? Sure he is. But he's about to commit mass murder. And the murder of a whole bunch of people who are not complicit in their master's foolishness and meanness. And Abigail persuades him to do otherwise. So here's what David says, verse 32. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me, and blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would not have been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male. David received the provision, said, go up to your house in peace. I have listened. I have granted your request. David recognizes the wisdom. Okay, so how, given all this, how would you describe Abigail's character from this little bit we see of her anyway? Throw some words out there that describe it. Let's see if they work.
Wise.
David concedes that she's wise. She's spoken very wisely to him. She's prevented a catastrophe not only on her own family, but for David himself. Okay. What else? Okay. Okay. And this is why she's in our... She has an active faith. She is faced with a crisis that has spiritual dimensions to it, and she takes action. By the way, did it take courage for her to do this?
And she okay. did it quickly.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Again, presumably David, I mean, she meets David. He's on his way to do the deed. Yeah. Okay. And again, her appeal to David is on the basis of what the Lord expects and what the Lord is going to do for David. And you know, maybe there's, maybe there, without trying to read things into what she says, her conviction that God is, or in fact already has, restrained David from shedding blood, this is not consistent with David's faith in God or with God's expectations of David. She expresses really a confidence that he's going to choose the right thing, and a great confidence that that God will reward David. God will bless David in his own time, which... Is that not the same confidence David expressed when he was telling his men, no, it's not time to kill Saul. God will do this in his own time. Abigail was simply reinforcing that to David in a time when David's mind and judgment are clouded by anger. Other questions, comments, before we think about our counterexample for the day?
One little side. Mm-hmm. You know, God took care of Nabal, and there's instances where God kills people. And I just think about the finality of that and the judgment that comes with them there in verse 38. At, you know, 10 days later, after I guess this episode, mm-hmm. God strikes down Nabal, and he died. It doesn't go any more than that, but you know that it was not a good position.
Right. Yeah, good point. We've seen the influence Abigail was able to exert on David. Do you think that this woman of faith and wisdom and graciousness tried to exert the same influence on her husband? The Bible doesn't say, but it's hard... It's very difficult for me to imagine that she didn't try. But as the servant said, he was such a worthless man that nobody could talk to him. Okay. You meet people like that, something they are so determined to have their way, they will not listen to reason. Nabal was that kind of man. I mention that because here is a woman who sought to be a godly influence on the people around her. She was unsuccessful with her husband, apparently. She was immediately successful with David because he was a man of entirely different character than Nabal was. Our counterexample today is famous. We read about her in the book of 1 Kings. 1 Kings 16 we want to go to. Who are we talking about? All right. True story, when we moved to the Spring Warrior congregation in Perry, there was a lady in the congregation who had some health problems. And, you know, folks up there, I mean, they've got that thick North Florida, South Georgia kind of accent. And they would make announcements about this woman. I think she may have been in the hospital or recovering. And I thought for all the world for about a month, this woman's name was Jezebel. And I thought, who in the modern era would name their kid? Well, it turned out her name was Jessie Bell. Okay. It's just, you know, okay. You know, wonderful lady, and we loved her and her husband so much. But I always think of that when I talk about Jezebel, because I mean, she ruined the name. You know, I don't know about the name before she came along. It's like, you know, nobody names their kid Adolf these days, okay? Because the name's just tainted. Jezebel, same way. So who is Jezebel? 1 Kings 16. Who is she? All right. She becomes queen of Israel. She's the wife of King Ahab. Where is she from? All right. She's from Sidon in Phoenicia. Daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidon. And right away, the Bible text is critical of Ahab for marrying her. And upon marrying her, what do we see Ahab do? All right. We see Ahab build a house, i.e. a temple for Baal and an altar to Baal in that temple, and also an Asherah. And these were very common expressions of Canaanite and Phoenician deities. Baal and then Asherah was supposed to be the female consort of the god Baal usually. That just tells us that's her influence. He does that to make her happy. And next thing you know, Baal worship has more or less become the national religion in the northern kingdom, the state religion. Fast forward a couple of chapters to chapter 18, and you have Elijah's contest with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. You know, he challenges Israel, how long will you halt between two opinions? If the Lord is God, then follow him. If Baal, then follow him. And he says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to build altars to God and to Baal, and whoever's God answers by fire, he's the real God. Everybody says, okay. Now, that's the backstory. It is, in chapter 18, how many prophets of Baal are part of this contest? All right? And that just tells you how extensive and how important Baal worship had become in the circles of influence in Samaria and other places in the northern kingdom. By the way, who wins the contest? We'll quiz for you there. There is no contest, right, okay. You know, you almost feel sorry for the Baal prophets, almost, not quite. You know, because they're just, you know, they're doing everything possible to get their God's attention, and Elijah is having a lot of fun at their expense. He's mocking them. And then, of course, the true God answers in unmistakable fashion. But after that happens, verse chapter 19, and by the way, after that happens, Elijah orders that all these prophets of Baal be executed. After that, what does Jezebel do in chapter 19? Okay. Yeah, she says, may the same be done to me and more if I don't make you like one of them by tomorrow. It's a nice way of saying you're a dead man. And so Elijah, you know, feels forced to flee from the royal court. Then we get to chapter 21. Uh, And 1 Kings 21 is a, in some ways it's a really good insight into Ahab's character. This fellow named Naboth has a vineyard and Ahab wants it. And he makes Naboth a proposition, and Naboth respectfully, but certainly, you know, within his rights, refuses. You know, this is my family's property. Why should, you know? And Ahab just is like a little child, just pouts and sulks over this. This is almost classic stuff here that you see repeated in real life and in fictional stories. You know, the king is just acting like a petulant child, and the queen, who is evil and manipulative, says, "Don't worry, honey, I'll get you what you want. I'll get Naboth's vineyard for you." Well, how does she do that?
She hatched her little plan and had evil men to swear that Naboth had cursed God, really.
Okay, yeah, all right. For which the penalty was, yeah. And so she has an innocent man put to death on false charges so that her husband can seize this man's vineyard. Okay. Now, what does all of that, especially chapter 16, where they have building the house for Baal and the altar for Baal and the Asherah, chapter 18, Baal prophets becoming prolific in the land, chapter 21, Jezebel's, in chapter 19, Jezebel's feeling authorized to issue a death threat to God's prophet. Chapter 21, her exerting this kind of twisted plan just to get Ahab a piece of land he wants. What does all this say about her influence on her husband? Does she have influence over her husband? Yeah, okay. She has tremendous influence on her husband. Is it good influence? This is the total opposite of Abigail. They're both married to fools. Okay. But Abigail does everything she can to mitigate her husband's foolishness, to undo the damage that it does. She even pleads for his life. And Jezebel just uses her husband's foolishness, enables it to get her way, in order to get her own way. Completely different perspective. Now, given all of that, what does that say about the degree to which faith, or a lack of it, can influence the people that are closest to me? Especially, in this case, a spouse. Okay, all right. We've got a couple of New Testament passages that our lesson brings up to kind of highlight that. Let's start with the second one, 1 Peter chapter 3. Can I get somebody to read 1 Peter chapter 3? Let's just start with just verses 1 and 2 for now. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 and 2. Larry, go ahead.
Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives, when they see the purity and reverence of our lives.
Okay. So Peter tells Christian wives to be submissive to their husbands. Toward what end in this particular instance? All right. So that even if you're married to a Nabal, even if you're married to somebody who is disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by their observance of your conduct. So again, what does Peter reiterate about the amount of influence a wife can have on her husband? Is it just a little bit? Is it a whole lot? Yeah, it's tremendous. Okay. And he goes on to, you know, talk about emphasizing not outward appearance, but the hidden person of the heart and the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which would be a great description of Abigail, what Peter gives there. He even gives the example of Sarah and Abraham, in verse 6. Abraham was no Nabal, but he describes her subjection to and to him and her godly character. So there is an evangelistic witness that is present in a person's godly character. Lots of passages talk about that, but in particular, Peter emphasizes the wife and her ability to influence her husband. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you have some similar words from Paul about the degree to which we may or may not be able to influence a spouse. And that brings me back to Abigail. She's in this marriage. We're all assuming, probably rightly, that she didn't have the option not to marry Nabal. This was an arranged marriage to a wealthy man, and this was just what was expected. That was very common. I think that it was really, I expect, the norm. Does she make the best of it? Does she allow him to influence her character? I mean, does she become a daughter of Belial? Does she become foolish? No, she doesn't. And she goes to great lengths, again, to try and as best she can, minimize the damage that her husband's foolishness does. Even trying to clean things up when he doesn't know. And she's busy working to try and fix that. And this is, and again, in teaching, I try to emphasize, this is what happens very often when a Christian young lady, it can work the other way too, marries somebody of bad character. And not to get off subject, but you know what the common response is, right? When you're warning them about that, I see heads nodding. What do they always say? I can fix him. Or you just don't know him like I do. And and sometimes, again, guys can do this too. I just see it more with girls. We'll act as if as soon as they say I do, his character is just magically going to change for her. And it usually doesn't work that way. Even though she's trying to exert godliness, Peter says it can. Okay? And Peter is probably talking to Christian women who were already married to their husbands when they became Christians. So they're trying to make the best of that situation. It can be an influence. But again, why choose to marry a Nabal when you don't have to? Well, we've seen two examples, one of great faith, one of the opposite of faith. And the degree to which these women influenced their husbands and influenced, in Abigail's case, someone, the man who ended up becoming her husband later on, influenced others. About out of time. Questions or comments before we finish up today? Barry, go ahead.
That last comment about Abigail kind of goes to the last part of 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6, where it encourages women to do good without fear. And I think that's really what we see in Abigail, because she didn't tell her husband what she was about to do to warn Nathan or to go to Nathan. She did it without fear.
Right. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Appreciate all your thoughts this morning, and we'll pick up with our next lesson on Wednesday night.